Welcome again to the final session of our seminar, which is entitled Substance and Shadow, in which we are trying to go over the basics of Vedic philosophy, and from these basics we are trying to unravel all the knots in our philosophical understanding, which we have acquired from non-Vedic sources. So from the Vedic perspective, we are able to perceive the truth in sense perception, in thought or anuman, and certainly ultimately in shabda, in spiritual sound or authoritative testimony. So we've been in the last few days discussing how we should use sense perception, pratyaksha, and anuman, our reasoning, in accordance with shabda. Today, we will talk about shabda, spiritual sound itself. Shabda is the source of our senses and sense perception. It is the source of our mind and our thoughts. And it is a source of proper knowledge how to use our senses and our mind. So, this is Bhagavatam philosophy. I don't think I need to go over that here. You can read in Srimad Bhagavatam how shabda, sound, is the creative principle behind this material manifestation. Srila Prabhupada writes, I've quoted him in this book, "It is stated in the Vedanta Sutra that sound is the origin of all objects of material possession. And by that sound, one can also dissolve this material existence. Anavriti Shabdat means liberation by sound. The entire material manifestation began from sound, and sound can also end material entanglement if it has a particular potency." So, that particular potency to liberate us from birth and death arises from purity of desire. Shabda, sound, when it is transmitted by one who is free from impure desire, and when it is also received purely, that has the potency to end samsara, the cycle of birth and death. So, that particular potency, that purity, is actually Lord Krishna himself. Lord Krishna, as he explains in Bhagavad Gita 7.1, "My asakta manaparta yogam yunjan mad asaya asangshayang samagram mam yata jashyasi tatshrinu." So tatshrinu means hear from me. So this transmission of pure spiritual sound, which is arising from pure desire, this begins with Krishna himself. He is the origin of this sound. And that sound retains its potency inasmuch as it is handed down the line of pure receivers of that sound who transmit it onward to others who similarly receive that sound purely. So this means the entire chain of the cyclic succession is pervaded by Krishna. Krishna himself is the potency of the transmission of this pure sound, which is liberating. So, Srila Prabhupada says, Krishna is within all of our hearts. Krishna or God is situated in everyone's heart. As you become purified, He speaks. He speaks always. But in our impure condition, we cannot hear. So Lord Krishna is in the heart. He is the source of Shabda. Even now. Even now. He is speaking to us. And also, we are experiencing the results. Even now, even in contaminated consciousness, we are experiencing the effect of that Shabda. But if we are impure, then we cannot experience that Shabda purely. We cannot actually grasp the real purport. So therefore, when one's desire is impure, then that Shabda comes to us through the false ego. And thus it is experienced in another way. When we receive Shabda through false ego, then we do not experience the transcendental effect of the sound vibration. Rather, we experience this material world. So, Srila Prabhupada explains that sound, all sound, Shabda, originates in the spiritual sky. That is the original point. The spiritual sky is resonant with the glories of Krishna. Just like you see and hear here in Sridham Mayapur. This is a place of glorification of Krishna. What are we hearing emanating from the temple? We're hearing the kirtan. We're hearing the class. And it's pervading the sky all around. So, this Sridham Mayapur is a sample of the spiritual world, which by Lord Chaitanya's mercy has been introduced within this dark material shell of the universe. So the whole spiritual world, this is a sample. So this unlimited spiritual sky is one endless Gaur Purnima festival. There the devotees are always chanting and singing the glories of the Lord, and the spiritual sky is always resonant with those transcendental vibrations. And the same Lord is within our heart. The same Krishna is within our heart. And from Him are similarly resonating vibration. But because our hearts are clouded by material desires, by false ego, therefore, we understand this sound differently. So there's a region in the all-effulgent spiritual world, there is one region called the Mahatattva, which Srila Prabhupada compares to a cloud. Just as we see now the sky is clear, but there may appear on the horizon one cloud, one dark cloud. So similarly, in one corner of the spiritual sky, there is the Mahatattva, which is the realm of collective false ego. And then within this Mahatattva, there is of course Lord Mahavishnu, and from Him are breathed out the universes, unlimited universes, and the Lord enters into each one of these universes. Bhagavatam says the shell of the universe is like the heart of the Lord. The Lord enters into it, just as we enter into the heart of this body as jiva. Also the Lord is entering into the heart of this body as Paramatma. But initially, the great circumference of this whole universe is compared to the heart, the guha. Guha means heart. And so Lord Garbhadakshaya Vishnu enters there and lays down. And then He fills that whole universe with what is called prana. Prana means the energy of life. And this prana is vibrating. And that vibration is Veda. Spiritual sound, Shabda. And so that prana is otherwise understood as Akash, ether, the first of the material elements. Prabhupada says we have within our body also prana and Akash, the life air. And it's by the potency of this prana that all of the internal functions of this body are being carried out. We do not understand. We are not aware of the beating of the heart, the movement of the blood through the veins and the arteries, functions of the brain and the nervous system, and all of the digestion, all of the things that are happening in this body. So complex. Even when scientists look at one living cell, just one cell of the body, they compare it to looking at a whole planet in a telescope. When they look at a cell in the microscope, it's like looking at an entire planet in a telescope. It is so complex and detailed, so many things are happening. And the scientists admit, we cannot comprehend all this, even in one cell, what to speak of the whole body. So all this movement, all this activity, it is going on due to the prana, the life energy of the Lord, which is pervading this whole universe. And again, within this prana or akash, there is shabda. So, the Lord is within our heart, within the heart of this body, and similarly, prana is pervading this body. And the active principle of this prana is shabdas, the Vedic sound. But because we're receiving this Vedic sound now through false ego, therefore the effect is different. We experience through this prana or akash what Prabhupada calls the objects of material possession, beginning with this body, this material body. This is how we're experiencing the shabda right now, in the form of this material body, and then onward, all the perceptions that we have of this world. And within all these perceptions, because it is all happening against the background of false ego, we are thinking all of this is mine. This body is mine, the objects of perception are mine, this world is mine. So what has happened is that we put ourselves in the place of the Ishwar, of the Supreme Lord. And thus, He is invisible to us. And because He is invisible to us, because we are out of touch with Him, therefore we are unable to know in this conditioned state the real purport of Vedic sound. Just like I've mentioned a bit more in detail in this second book, Transcendental Personalism, how the Western scientists, they have also in their investigation of matter, they have also finally come down to the principle, the background principle or fundamental principle of vibration, which they in their terminology call the wave function. The quantum wave function. And we have to be very cautious. By mentioning this, I do not mean to say, you know, there are some devotees who are a bit liberal and they like to think, they're probably getting their ideas from optimistic, mystically minded scientists. And they like to think that that modern science is proving Vedic knowledge, or at least some of it proves Vedic knowledge. Well, modern science doesn't prove anything. Because modern science or material science, we have to keep in mind, it is ever changing. So you have to be very, very cautious before going around and saying things like, now scientists have understood that ultimately everything is coming from Shabda. They have not understood any such thing, but just that they're currently, their mental speculations can be observed to be somewhat similar to some aspects of Vedic knowledge. But if you look over the history of modern science, you see that all their theories change in time. So we can point out this particular similarity now, but maybe in 20 years it will no longer be there. So you have to always keep that in mind. Don't be too optimistic about the statements of modern science. Anyway, but it is interesting to note that in older times, when scientists would talk about the fundamental, you know, fundamental nature, fundamental matter, then they would talk about it in terms of atoms and the void. This goes all the way, this goes back some 2,500 years to the ancient Greeks. There was a Greek atomic philosopher named Democritus. And you may know in India also there was Kanada, even older than Democritus, who also had an atomic theory. So, of course, the Vaisheshika philosophy has much more in common with Vedic understanding than the ancient Greek atomic philosophy. Democritus, he reduced reality down to atoms and the void. And so for a long, long time in European science, this idea was maintained, that everything reduces to atoms and void. Maybe in school, I don't know, you may have even seen, they give you at least in the school books I saw, a kind of idealistic, very nice picture of an atom, and you see some nucleus composed of protons and neutrons, and spinning around like satellites are the electrons. Everyone's seen that symbol of the atom, you know. It's completely bogus. I'm not talking just from Vedic point of view, but even now the scientists themselves say, we don't know what atoms look like. This is just our speculation of a particular period in time. And they put it on all the school books, and you had to pass tests on this. But now they tell you, it doesn't matter anyway, just a speculation. Such is modern science. So this whole idea of atoms as something like atoms or particles as something like billiard balls, you know, which fly through space and bump into each other, and some of them then separate and fly in different directions. Others, they stick to one another and get bigger and form molecules. This idea actually goes back to the Greeks, but it is no longer considered valid. In very modern science, they reduce reality to what they call the wave form. Appearing out of this wave form, particles just pop into existence and then go back into non-existence or back into the wave form. I'm giving a very approximate explanation. At least this is what I understood from what I read. But in any case, we can, by turning to the Vedic explanation, make some sense out of this. Yes, that the fundamental background of our material experience is vibration, is Shabda. And appearing within these vibrations are, just as we read in the Bhagavatam, coming out of Shabda from ether, then comes air, from air comes fire, from fire comes water, and from water comes earth, and parallel to that are our sensory experiences, hearing, and then feeling, and then sight, and then taste, and then touch, and then smell. No, touch I already mentioned. Huh? Taste, yes. Taste and then smell. So all of that, that experience, our total experience of this world, is ultimately based on Shabda. So what we know as matter is an experience that arises out of vibration. And it seems to me, from what I understand, in a very general way, the modern scientists are trying to say the same thing. There's some fundamental waveform. Now, but the major, major difference is, of course, they can propose no origin for this waveform. There is no law governing this waveform. They say it is all just chance. You see? Simply blind chance. It is by blind chance, first of all. They don't know why this waveform is there. They say, you cannot ask beyond it. There's nothing more to say beyond this thing. And why this world has come out as it has from that waveform is just chance. Just accident. Now, anyway, I won't get into that. I've discussed something about the idea of chance. Actually, when you use this term chance, it only makes sense when you have something like a die, you know, this cube with the dots on it. So this is something you know. You know that it has six sides, and you know that it has 1 to 6 dots. Then you can talk sensibly about chance. I'll throw this, and there's a 1 in 6 chance of a certain number coming up. That's chance. But when you talk about something you don't know, you don't really know what it is, and then you start to talk about chance, you're not making any sense whatsoever. You cannot talk about chance. It's just ignorance. So anyway, the material scientists, they speculate that there is some fundamental vibration, but they don't know what it is. They certainly don't know what that vibration means to say. But that is revealed in the Vedic scriptures. So, so for those who are under false ego, then out of this fundamental vibration of prana, then our consciousness becomes filled up with what Prabhupada calls mundane names and forms. That is this world. Nama Rupa, names and forms. That is actually this world. A world of names and forms. So, and these mundane names and forms, they're constantly agitating us. We're under false ego, and the false ego is constantly agitated by these names and forms. And so to try to deal with this agitation of the basic names and forms, as I said, like earth, water, fire, air, ether, and sound, touch, smell, and so on. These are basic things. So to try to deal with them, deal with that agitation, then our minds multiply so many more names and forms. And that results in our human civilization. So this multiplication of materialistic name and forms comes under two categories, karmavad and jnanavad. So karmavad is based on pratyaksha, sense perception, and jnanavad is based on anuman, mental speculation. So now, the Vedas, very nicely, the Vedic sound, gives us a process by which we can purify our sense perception and our mental speculation. That process is called yajna, sacrifice. So that means, yes, under false ego, we are claiming objects of bodily attachment as our own. these perception and our thoughts, our ideas as our own. So Yajna directs us, you take these and you offer them in service to the Lord. See? You take the objects of sense perception and you take your mental functions and you engage them in sacrifice to the Lord. And thus, gradually you become purified of false ego. So there are teachers who teach these processes of karma yajna and jnana yajna. And Prabhupada says these teachers who are sons of Brahma. So there's Daksha, who is the leader of the karmis, and there's the four kumaras, who are the leaders of the jnanis. But apart from this gradual process of purifying our egoistic attachment to our perceptions and our thoughts, there's a pure process. And this is the process of bhakti, pure devotional service, which is taught by Narada Muni, who is described in Shastra as Bhakta Avatar. He is the very incarnation of a devotee in this world. So, by this process, the sound vibration in its original pure sense is transmitted. Not in the sense of, again, materialistic attachment, the mundane sound coming through the false ego, but the pure sound which has the potency to liberate us. And that is Shabda Brahma, spiritual sound. So again, this sound is coming originally from Krishna, as he speaks in Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam. And Brahma, the creator, he receives this sound from Krishna and transmits it onward. And Narada, in particular, he receives this sound from his father Brahma purely and transmits it onward. And this is the origin of our Brahma Sampradaya. So this is parampara. Parampara means one after another. There is one teacher after another who is, as you know this expression, transparent via media. There's no false ego. There is no unconscious editing of that sound so that it will come out only as karma kanda or only as jnana kanda. But the full message is transmitted. And thus, the parampara is compared to a linking of hearts. So, the Lord, He resides in our heart. And when we become linked to Him through the pure heart of the spiritual master, the Lord in all His purity resides in the heart, but we can access Him, we can come in contact with Him only through the transparent via media of the pure heart of our spiritual master. Because there is nothing in the heart of the spiritual master which is clouding the Lord and His divine message. So this brings us to the five stages of Vedic knowledge, which I've explained in chapter 3 of Substance and Shadow. So these five stages, and I've given the references where you can find these in Srila Prabhupada's books and his lectures and so on. That's in the index. But the five stages are pratyaksha, paroksha, aparoksha, adhoksaja, and aprakrita. And so these are stages of development of our Krishna consciousness. We all begin on the pratyaksha stage. That means when you first come in contact with the devotees of the Lord, how do you understand them? Through your senses, isn't it? Everyone, I suppose, can remember the first time they saw devotees. And you were seeing these people with their strange hair and dress and the mark on their forehead. and they were singing a song. Probably, if you saw them in kirtan, they were singing a song that you had never heard before. Or if you met a book distributor, he was offering you a book that you had never seen before, with a title that you could hardly figure out. So, it's basically pratyaksha. Pratyaksha means we're just seeing like little children, like a baby sees. Baby sees things and cannot comprehend. So when we first come in contact with the pure devotees, it's pratyaksha. But because these devotees are pure, therefore even that pratyaksha becomes purified. So just by association, just by hearing and seeing, and like children do, then children imitate. Or we say, monkey see, monkey do. So just by, yes, associating, hearing, seeing, and imitating, then one's whole existence is becoming purified. And this is how the whole process begins. Jive shakshat nahi tatu guru chaita rupa shiksha guru haite habi mahanta swarupa. This is from Chaitanya Charitamrita. That in our conditioned state, we cannot connect with the chaita guru, with the Lord in the heart, because our desire is impure. We are covered by false ego. But shiksha guru haite habi. So shiksha guru can mean any devotee. There's Diksha Guru, the one devotee who initiates us. But Shiksha Guru can mean any devotee who is qualified to transmit spiritual knowledge. So we come in contact with a devotee, Mahanta Swarup. He's in the form of a great soul. Mahanta means a great soul. So any devotee compared to the population of Kali Yuga is a great soul. So we come in contact with the devotees of the Lord. And this is our beginning in Krishna consciousness. And then this pratyaksha leads us onward to the next stage of purified knowledge, which is paroksha. Paroksha means knowledge through another senses. In this sense, we mean knowledge through the senses of the devotees. You see, just like the devotees, I can remember my first experience of paroksha was when I attended, in my first day of visiting a temple. I had been in the temple for about an hour and a half, so became a little bit oriented. I could understand a little bit what was going on. And then there was Tulsi Puja. And I couldn't understand what this meant. I saw a little plant in a pot brought out in the middle of the floor, and everyone was bowing down. So I also bowed down, not knowing why. And then we danced around this plant and we watered her. And I could not understand why. But then the devotees explained to me. So I was seeing through their senses. The devotees are saying, Tulsi Devi is a great devotee of Lord Krishna. She's most dear to Lord Krishna. The devotee was telling me, was saying this with such devotion, such sincerity, such certainty. So, through the senses of this devotee, then I was understanding what is Tulsi Devi. So this is paroksha stage. Or Prabhupada gives a very simple example. Just like now you're in India. So, you may get on the telephone, if you live far away, other side of the ocean, so you may get on the telephone and call a friend at your home, and he can ask you, at his place it is dark. That part of the world is still covered in darkness. But he can ask you, so how is it there in India? And you can say, oh, it's a beautiful sunny day. It's beautiful, the sun is out so bright. He only sees darkness. But through your eyes, through your testimony, he can get a sense that Yes, here the sun is shining. So this is a very simple example. So that's the next stage. We learn through the instructions of the devotees. And then this stage is followed by aparoksha, which means then you start to get your own realization of things. Just like, again, the example of Tulsi Devi. After you hear about Tulsi Devi, and you take up the process of worshipping her, then gradually you yourself realize that this is not an ordinary plant. So when you come into Tulsi Devi's presence, you're immediately very respectful. You bow down. You offer prayers to her. You feel in your heart great devotion for her. And we can have, you know, so many realizations along this line. We can realize when we chant japa in the presence of Tulsi Devi that our japa is so nice. And if we chant japa in the presence of, you know, some, I don't know, magnolia plant, some ordinary plant, that the effect is not the same. So this is all aparoksha, realization. So, also in our study of Srila Prabhupada's books, after pradyaksha and paroksha, after doing these, then gradually, as we read Srila Prabhupada's books, those statements which previously, when we were new devotees, we found very difficult to understand, or very difficult to accept even, suddenly, it's like a light goes on. And, oh yes, it makes perfect sense. So this is aparoksha. But then beyond that is adhoksaja. Because even at the aparoksha stage, we're reading, for instance, we're reading about the jiva. We're reading about material nature. We're reading about prakriti, material nature, and kala, time, and karma, activities, and ultimately the Ishwara, the Supreme Lord. And so at the aparoksha stage, we get a deeper and deeper perception of these things, but ultimately, we're still not seeing them directly. That comes at the next stage, adhoksaja. Adhoksaja is the name of the Paramatma. So when the Super Soul reveals these tattvas to us, in other words, you see Ishwara as He is, and you see the Jiva as He is, as in the words of the Isopanishad, to see all living entities as spiritual sparks, not to see, you know, as probably we do now, oh, here is this boy from Russia, and here is this girl from Bulgaria, and there is a tree, and there is a bird, and they're all spirit souls. We remember, as a philosophical principle, you see. But to actually see the jiva atma in the heart, or to actually see Prakriti as Durga Devi, the feminine material potency of the Lord, the Achit Shakti. Just like in the temple, in temples in South India, Shri Radha Madhav. So the Lord's expansion as Vishnu is worshipped, especially in South India, with Sri, Bhu, and Nila. There are three kinds of Shaktis. So the Bhu Shakti is particularly the material energy. Bhu Shakti, Bhu Devi. Bhu means earth. So this matter. So she's a person. Huh? So now we're not seeing that directly. Huh? We're remembering from Shastra this. But at the adhoksaja stage, one can see directly. Also in Bhagavatam, first canto, Srila Vyasadeva, he saw the Lord and the Lord's energy directly, and the jiva directly. And time, kala, is also an entity He's described in Scripture. Krishna says, I am time. He revealed his form as time to Arjuna. And he told Arjuna, unless I give you divine eyes, you cannot see this form. So this is the stage of revealed knowledge. When the curtain of the curtain of Maya is pulled back, and we can actually see the Lord and His potencies directly. But even this is not the ultimate stage. Of course, for those who simply worship Vishnu as supreme, this may be the ultimate stage. But for the Gaudiya Vaishnavas, there is even one more stage, and that is the stage of Aprakrita. So Aprakrita means beyond Prakriti. Because the Jiva, Prakriti, Kala, Karma potencies is still pertained to this material world. But this material world is, our theme is substance and shadow. So the material world is a shadow of the spiritual world. The forms of this material world are deriving their existence from the transcendental forms of the spiritual world. And that is a prakriti, that is non-material, that is purely spiritual, and it is full of nectar. So at this stage, then the Shabda Praman, the spiritual sound, is nectarian. It is, as Srila Rupa Goswami, we find so many prayers, but Rupa Goswami is saying about the chanting of the holy name, whenever I chant the holy name of Krishna, then I desire to have millions of tongues, so I can chant more and more, and millions of ears, so that I can hear more and more. Why? Because that sound vibration is so sweet. So this is the ultimate stage of Vedic knowledge. And of course, this is the stage in which one enters into the transcendental Leela of Shishi, Radha and Krishna in Goloka Vrindavan. So can someone tell me what time it is?
7 to 12,
okay. So there's just one last thing I wanted to state. I just wanted to briefly say, which is also a point, and I consider a very important point in chapter 3. And that's about the original sense of words. We've been talking about pure Shabda. But there is an impure Shabda, an impure sound. And we experience that in ordinary language, people talking their nonsense, their prajalpa, or even the words of big material scientists and philosophers. As we've been saying in other days, they make their pronouncements as if this is all absolute truth. But it is not. But the thing is that we can realize by studying even ordinary language that the original sense of words cannot be explained in terms of pratyaksha or even anumana. And I've given an extensive explanation of that. So I just want to very briefly summarize that. Take the word airplane. So there are some people who say this word can only have meaning in relationship to specific winged vehicles, specific airplanes. We know what an airplane is because there are winged vehicles that we can see. But this is defective. And this is admitted by philosophers that is defective. Because once I know what the word airplane means, then I don't have to relearn it with every new airplane that I see. Because there's so many different airplanes. You see? There's the old-fashioned airplane with two wings, top and bottom. So if that was the first airplane I saw, I'm told that is an airplane. And then later I see a jet plane. But I know immediately, all forms of airplanes wherever I may see them are airplanes. So how is it that I know that? So that means that the sense of words goes beyond our perception. So that defeats the pratyakshavadis. But then the anumanavadis will say, well, that's because airplane is an idea. It's an idea in the mind. But this is also defective, because anuman means mental speculation. So when I see an airplane, you see a new airplane for the first time. Have any of you had the experience that you've had to think first what that is? You've had to reach in some dictionary in your mind? This is a new airplane, so what? Oh yes. Yes, this corresponds to the idea of airplane. Yes, so it is an airplane. No, instantly you know what it is. You don't have to consult some mental dictionary. So the meaning of words even goes beyond mental speculation. I'm talking here, and you're not having to check in your mind the meaning of the words I'm saying. You know, you're not having to retranslate them. Of course, we have a translator to get it into the proper language. But receiving words is not a mental process, unless it's a word that you do not know. And then you may have some doubt about it. But words that we understand, or words, are in a category of their own. And this is what I've given you is an argument that is even accepted in Western philosophy. So, but what is that original sense of words? What is that dimension in which words are existing? The Western philosophers don't know. So the one who tried to explain it was a philosopher named Wittgenstein, and he was a kind of mystic. And he was saying the words are the vehicles of our thoughts. Words carry our thoughts, not that our thoughts carry words. And then if you ask, well, where do these words come from? He would just say, words just exist. So this is not very helpful. So what we learned from Vedanta Sutra is, and I've quoted this verse, is that every word is originally a name of God. Every word. It gets its meaning because it has its origin in God. Every word is meant to glorify God. Every word. Even the word airplane. Because there are original transcendental bimanas in the spiritual world. And why do they exist? For the glorification of Krishna. They're another aspect of the glories of the spiritual world. So, that idea of a viman, of a winged vehicle, is carried by the shabda, the sound vibration from which this world is manifesting. So therefore, that idea also appears in our consciousness, in human consciousness. And so, materialistic human beings, by karma, and jnana, by theory and by experiment, they have developed airplanes. You see? I hope I made this clear. I can't expand it because we don't have any time. So, but the original sense of the word airplane is spiritual, and all words. That's where they get their meaning from. And finally, someone had asked about controversy. We say that shabda is the ultimate proof, but then someone can point out, but we find there is controversy even in shabda, even in scripture. And thus there are arguments based on scripture. What about that? Yes, well, the argument aspect is coming from the false ego. Argument means that false ego is involved somewhere. But actually, the Lord and His glories, and also the scriptures, which are presenting to us the Lord and His glories, they are compared to a Vaidurya stone. That's a certain kind of gem. So you look at this Vaidurya stone, it has many facets, many sides, and you can see one side looks blue, one side looks green, one side looks red. Now, is there any controversy here? Is it only if there's some false ego? We can all understand that this jewel is glorious, and because it is so nice, so wonderful, therefore it has these seemingly contradictory aspects that one side is red. So I may say from my side, my angle of vision, this is a red jewel. You're sitting on the other side, you may say, it is a green jewel. And someone else may say, it is a blue jewel. Now there's no occasion for argument if our intention is to glorify the jewel. Then we can all agree, oh, this jewel is so wonderful that I see it as red, you see it as green, and he sees it as blue. What is the problem? But when there's false ego, then I'm saying, it is only red, and you are wrong. So, there is actually, among the pure bhakti shastras, we've said that the pure shabda is the bhakti shastra, that shastra or that shabda which pertains to pure devotion to the Lord. That is a pure essence. There is also, yes, this karma shabda, this jnana shabda. And that is infected by false ego. But when we talk about the pure sound vibration that originates in the Lord and is handed down by the disciplic succession, there is actually no controversy. There is simply a wonderful variety which to a limited materialistic mind may seem to be contradictory. But for the devotees of the Lord who love Krishna and know that Krishna is achintya guna, like Brahma Sangita says, achintya guna swarupa, his form is full of inconceivable qualities. This is like the story of the cobbler and the Brahmin. You know this story with Narada Muni. So, although he was a Brahmin, he could not accept that Lord Narayan would thread an elephant through the eye of a needle. He said, this is impossible. You could not have seen Lord Narayan. Why? Because this description does not correspond to my logic. My limited logic. But the simpler cobbler said, this is the power of my Lord. It is not astonishing actually, because I can see, I have my shoemaking place under this great tree, and I see how the Lord has placed this tree within one seed. A whole tree is within one little seed, and when the seed goes into the ground, the whole tree. This is inconceivable, achintya. Who can understand it? This is the power of Krishna. So that is devotee. So this is the answer to the question about controversies on the arising from Shabda itself, pure Shabda. There is no controversy. But we can artificially make controversy through false ego. Okay, so I'll stop here. Questions, yes?
I have two questions. One, in the 11th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, describe four stages through which the pure sound is passed by.
Yes.
It was very unclear. I cannot understand it.
He's asking about, in the Srimad Bhagavatam, there are four stages through which sound appears in this world. So these four stages are, if I remember them correctly, Para, Vaikriti, Madhyama, and last one, I don't quite remember. But, yes, this is mentioned in the Bhagavatam, and this is a subject of great speculation, especially among the Karma Mimamsa philosophers. And they try to explain this in so many ways. But and also in mystic yoga. So it all seems to be very mystical. But in our Vaishnava philosophy, we have a very simple resolution of that. So simultaneous with these four stages of sound, there's the Chaturvyuha, Vasudev, Sankarshan, Pradumna, Aniruddha. So Vasudev, he's at the Para stage, transcendental Lord in Vaikuntha, and then he has his expansions. So Sankarshan, he's the Lord of the Tamoguna, and that means the Lord of gross matter. Then there's Pradumna, who is the Lord of the senses, which are passionate. And then there's Aniruddha, the Lord of the mind, which is in the mode of goodness. And there are many parallels of four. There's also Turiya, the fourth transcendental platform. And then the three modes of material nature, Sushupti, Svapna, Jagrata. So these... So, to answer your question very simply, very concisely, so, yes, the origin of sound is transcendental, above the modes of material nature, but as sound is appearing in this world, it is passing through the three modes, goodness, passion, and ignorance, which, that can be explained in many ways, bhur, bhuva, sva, celestial, middle, lower, or mind, senses, sense objects, or so many ways, and then the different philosophers argue about these ways. But the transcendental stage, and then goodness, passion, and ignorance, these are predominated by forms of the Lord Himself. As I said, Vasudev, Sankarshan, Pradumna, Aniruddha. So when you keep that in mind, then it becomes hopefully very clear that these different kinds of sound are simply potencies, specific potencies of different forms of the Lord. Yeah? What is the difference between written word and spoken word? Ultimately, there is no difference because, as I said, Shabda is coming down from the spiritual platform, and then it is passing through stages from subtle to gross. So the subtlest form of sound is a thought. When you think something, that is actually Shabda, but it is subtle. So similarly, when you read, what are you doing? You're reading, and these marks on the page, these symbols on the page, are appearing in your mind as words. So that is Shabda. And if you speak, if you read out loud, that is Shabda, just on a more physical platform. So Shabda, Shabda permeates all platforms of existence.
I mean that you said that the spoken word may be clear, that it depends of clear desire.
Yes.
The written word,
it's the same with the written word. If someone with an impure heart writes something, that will also contaminate your consciousness if you read it. You understand? Is that the point of your question? Yeah. Certainly. I mean, that's why Bhagavatam compares other literatures, materialistic literatures, to a garbage heap, a place of pilgrimage of the crows. Crows go there. They have crow, they have crow taste, and so the mundane writers, they're throwing out garbage for these crows. Yes, Prabhu. Well, of course, it is coming down that way. It is coming down from the Aprakrita platform. It is descending downward. But we, from our position, we're starting from Pratyaksha. You know, as conditioned souls. When we first come in contact with the pure sound vibration, we receive it through our Pratyaksha, obviously. Pratyaksha includes hearing. So when you first hear the Hare Krishna mantra, you don't know what it means. You don't have any aparoksha is equivalent to anuman. You don't have any mental conception, really, what it is. You see? You're just hearing this sound, Hare Krishna. You're hearing it. And that already has potency. So I've explained these stages in terms of our spiritual progress towards the goal. But obviously it's coming down from the topmost platform to our platform. And that's by the mercy of the Lord. Yes?
Maharaj, I want to ask about the process of purification. You were speaking about how the desire influences the reception of the Shabda. If the desire is not pure, then there is false ego. But is the potency of Shabda dependent on the recipient's quality? I mean, because sometimes it's said that one may not hear attentively even the class, but the Shabda is working on it.
Yes.
How is this?
He's asking a question that it was, this point was made that when our desires are impure, then although Krishna is in our heart speaking to us, we cannot hear him. So then he's asking that now we're hearing in this Krishna consciousness movement, but can we really assume that that is full potency because we still may have impure desires in the heart? Well, Bhaktivinoda Thakur speaks about this in his Harinam Chintamani. So there's what he calls Shraddha Namabhas. So Namabhas means the reflection of the holy name, or the light, the illumination of the holy name, such as at sunrise, before the sun actually comes up over the horizon, the sky is flooded with light and you can see everything. So we at our present stage, because yes, there is still some contamination in the heart, therefore we understand that this is our level of hearing and chanting, Namabhas. Namaparad is the lowest level. That means actually making offenses against the holy name. So we should avoid those offenses. So then we are chanting and hearing Namabhas. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur says one should do this with Shraddha. Shraddha Namabhas. Shraddha means with faith. And so by chanting and hearing, even though it is not the Shuddha Nam, Shuddha Nam means the name which is perceived as Krishna himself. There is no difference at the platform of Shuddha Nam between the Lord and his name. But at Namabhas, we are conceiving still of some difference. We're not able to directly understand that this name, Krishna, is Krishna himself, Shamsundar, holding the flute with peacock feather in his hair. But if we have faith in the process, then this faith will carry us over these lingering material desires in the heart. And so that faith then is perceived in our adherence to spiritual authority, Guru, Shastra, Sadhu, in the sadhana bhakti process which is given for us to follow. That is the proof of our faith. If one is taking everything very whimsically, very chaotically, under his own concocted plan, then although that we can understand that person is fortunate enough to come in contact with the process, he apparently does not have very much faith in it, because he's not applying himself very seriously. So Well, as long as there's contact, there will still be good effect, some good effect. If we accept the discipline, then this is like accepting the directives of a doctor. You are sick. When you go to the doctor, you're still sick. You see, but he's telling you, you're sick and I have the cure. So there's hope. You have shraddha, you have faith. He can help me. And so then he gives you a program for resuming your health, for the return of your health. That don't eat this, don't eat that. And take this medicine 3 times a day and take that medicine 1 a day. And don't do this and don't do that, but do this and do that. So if you have faith in him, then you'll follow that very, very religiously, and your health will recover in good time, very quickly. So when you go back to the doctor, you say, "Your doctor, you're completely right. It's very wonderful. This disease is almost gone now." But if one is whimsical, he takes the medicine as he likes. He does some things the doctor says, but not other things. Then obviously, the beneficial effect will be less. So shraddha, faith. This will carry us over, are these lingering contaminations in the heart. Yes? Yes.
All philosophies are just a place of words. It's just a combination of words. It's too gross. Language is too gross to reality.
Yes.
No philosophy can explain the absolute truth.
Yes. So his point is about the mundane philosophers of language. They say language is limited. It pertains only to this relative world. It cannot express anything absolute. We are prevented by language from doing that. So, I wish I would have had time in this 1 hour session to discuss that. But that is discussed at length in chapter 3 of this book. And the problem here is what is termed as the mirror theory of language. They think that language is like a mirror of our life in this world. That's all language can do. Words can only mirror human life. And so, yes, therefore they say it reflects this world, and if by mental speculation we determine that this world has actual no reality, then language also has no reality. And so they're left in their search for the absolute with mysticism. And mysticism is a process of coming to consciousness without any object. Because the only object is matter, and matter is illusion. So you have to remove that object, so there's only consciousness. You're conscious of nothing, in other words. And this is Mayavadi philosophy. So if you take it that words only reflect our material experience, then in coming to this consciousness of nothing, you have to get rid of words. So therefore, the true mystic is one who is silent. You see? But then, what you have just explained this philosophy with words. So this again is the paradox of self-reference. Wittgenstein, big philosopher, wrote so many books. You see, also Prabhupada used to talk about one Mayavadi named Krishnamurti, who wrote a book saying there's no need for teachers. Or in other words, he's saying, he wrote a book saying there's no need for books, because books teach things. So Prabhupada used to laugh about that. What is the use? He writes a book saying there's no books are of no use. So this is the this position, then it refutes itself. It negates itself. All these kind of philosophers, if they were actually sincere, then they would all be like this Cratylus, which I mentioned a few days ago, who refused to say anything. See? But at least we can credit him with being honest in his philosophy. People would go to him, "You're a great sage," and they would ask him questions, and he would not answer. There's no sense in answering. So as soon as you talk about a book expressing this philosophy that you've just expressed, it refutes itself. So we have no use for this. So in actual fact, as I just mentioned, the real sense of words is transcendental. The sense of words cannot be explained in terms of pratyaksha or anuman. And that is accepted nowadays. Actually, I give examples of this in chapter 3, and I took many of these examples from a book written by a modern philosopher. The book was called What Does It All Mean? I think, yeah, that was it. What Does It All Mean? So he was also pointing, giving very good examples. How you cannot find the value in words, in sense perception, or even mental speculation. It goes on. Another good example of this is you make a statement. Like I may say, there is an airplane in the sky. Now, right now, that doesn't correspond with our experience here. We don't see an airplane in the sky. You see? So, maybe I'm telling a lie. Maybe I'm saying this to mislead you. Or maybe I'm just, having a fantasy. Or I'm just saying something that I wish would happen. I wish that there would be an airplane in the sky. So, whatever, for whatever reason. But still, this sentence, there is an airplane in the sky, has meaning. And we all know what it means. Whether it is on the physical or mental platform, true or false, real or unreal, it still has meaning. So this is another proof that the meaning of words is beyond the physical and the mental. You understand? It's a very good argument. It's an excellent argument. It still has meaning. There's an airplane in the sky. There, you can say, but there is no air, but you know what I said. You understood it. It's not that these words have to connect with something out there. Because if there's no air, if that were the case, and there's no airplane in the sky, and I say there's an airplane in the sky, then by this logic, you would not be able to understand what I was saying. You see? If it were really so that words are linked with experience, then you would not be able to understand this statement, there's an airplane in the sky, unless there was an airplane in the sky. You understand? So the fact that you can still understand what I'm saying, although there's no airplane in the sky, proves that words have a transcendental sense. They have a sense that goes beyond the circumstances of our experience of this world. And so Vedanta philosophy, Vedic philosophy, is saying ultimately all words have their origin in God and their actual purpose is to glorify God. Because this whole material world is a reflection of the spiritual world, including the language. Including the language. Just like we say, this person is beautiful. Well, where does this idea come from? Where does such a concept come from, that somebody is beautiful? You see, it doesn't make sense to say it comes from matter. Because you just take a little razor blade, and you go to that beautiful person, and you cut that body open, and all kinds of bad things will fall out on the ground. You see, you analyze that thing that you call beautiful, and it's not beautiful. But still, somehow, we recognize this person is beautiful. Where does the beauty come from? You see? It actually comes from the spiritual world. It actually comes from Krishna. reflected in this world. And similarly, the language is reflected by which we express such thoughts that something is beautiful. So this is real philosophy. All right, so I stop here. Thank you very much for attending this seminar. Hare Krishna.
Jusota Saimaraj ki.
Thank you so much, Mama. One thing is that all this Lakshmi you got to sell in books, you're going to give to me in dollars. So you have to change. You got me.
The future. They say in 100 years rockets will go here, there. This is, they don't know, but they still they talk.
Otherwise, philosophers explain for us how to get it experience. Eh?
Yes. Exactly. There's a process. That's why this book is called The Vedic Method. Uh-huh. Method. You have to know what to do. Mm-hmm. Okay?
Yeah. All right. I just
yes. Some response to this one analysis of your this text which was recently published in ISKCON Communication Journal, and this one she professor from Italy, I think, so Lidia Graziano, mm-hmm. she made this observation, you know.
Yeah.
And can you maybe briefly only said what is her point of view or what you want to set against her, maybe some conception which was...
Well, I wrote an answer. I don't know if they published it.
You didn't publish that?
I don't know. Uh-huh. I sent it to Shona Karishi and he said a very good answer. Uh-huh. And he said he would publish it, but I don't read that ISKCON communication so much, so I didn't check
it. I don't know.
Yeah, but I think he published the answer.
Okay. I have a question regarding the first look of the Bhagavatam.
Yeah.
The meaning of Muhyanti Yatsuraya.
Mm-hmm.
What is the exact meaning of that statement? So according to Sridhar Swami, what I understand is that because Lord Brahma received a message from Lord Krishna, Lord Brahma is not 100% qualified to transmit the message. Because of that, these suras, they are bewildered by that message that they have received from Lord Brahma.
Well, Lord Brahma is, Prabhupada says he's the incarnation of Vedic knowledge, the incarnation of Vedic sound. But his particular purpose as creator is to give function or to give facility to the material desires of all living entities in this universe, which also includes the demigods to some extent. So to the degree of material desires that are there in the heart, to that degree the pure shabda is, you say, occluded, you know, it's like the moon but in a phase, you know, not full. So even Brahma himself, like it is said, he spoke Brahma Sangita. But even the full meaning, it's mentioned by Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, the full meaning of the statements of Brahma Sangita, were not revealed to him. Generally he was understanding, but there is a further, deeper meaning, which he could not grasp. So, but when Prabhupada was asked about Lord Brahma, you know, he was actually asked in Vrindavan in 1976.
Because he's our guru.
Yeah, how is it that he can be acharya? And, you know, and then they were saying because he was attracted to his daughter and this and that. And Prabhupada said, he may be whatever he may be, but still he is acharya. Because he is the one selected by Krishna through whom the Vedic knowledge manifests. So that means whatever so-called defects are there, still he is competent enough to transmit. Maybe he himself personally is not fully realized. I've heard it said that sometimes Brahma is in the mood of karmi, sometimes he's in the mood of jnani, sometimes he's in the mood of bhakta. this changes. So in some periods he may not be so much like a bhakta, you know, but still he's intelligent enough to pass on the scriptures unchanged without some contamination, although he may not be fully realized in them. And then because he's giving all these Vedic scriptures, including Karmakanda, Gyanakanda, then the suras, the demigods, they are taking according to their desires, and then these, you know, different schools of Vedic knowledge and come about which seem to contradict, and that, and then the human beings become very bewildered by that. But still, from Brahma comes that one pure line, the Brahma Sampradaya. Okay, thank you.
Hare Krishna.